You're listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2016 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please visit www.lfla.org/aloud. Ben Ehrenreich, who's also a novelist, is the recipient of a National Magazine Award for his intrepid journalism. Ben has reported from Afghanistan and Haiti, from the refugee jungle in Calais, France, from El Salvador, Cambodia, and the streets of Los Angeles. As research for his new book, an excerpt of which appeared as a New York Times Magazine article, Ben traveled to and lived in the West Bank, and over the course of 3 years, he lived with Palestinian families in its largest cities and smallest villages. His new book, The Way to the Spring, offers some of the most empathetic reporting ever to emerge from that turbulent region. His book is a brave and necessary immersion into the everyday struggles of Palestinian life. He makes it impossible to turn away. Tonight, Ben will talk about his book with Amy Willens, former Jerusalem correspondent for The New Yorker. Amy won the 2014 National Book Critics Circle Award for her book about Haiti, Farewell, Fred Voodoo. Her acclaimed novel, Martyr's Crossing, set in Jerusalem, explores the objective issues and subjective realities that form the fabric of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And we have copies of that for sale tonight as well. I'd like to start us off tonight before Amy and Ben join us on the stage. And I want to mention Amy is here in the spirit of the show must go on, even with a broken ankle. So wanted to let you know. She'll come scooting out. But I wanted to start us off tonight with two poems, one by the great Palestinian poet Mahmoud Darwish and the other by the late Israeli poet Yehuda Amichai. So this is Mahmoud Darwish. It's called I Belong There, and it's translated by Munir Akash and Carolyn Forche. I belong there. I have many memories. I was born as everyone is born. I have a mother, a house with many windows, brothers, friends, and a prison cell with a chilly window. I have a wave snatched by seagulls, a panorama of my own. I have a saturated meadow in the deep horizon of my word. I have a moon, a bird's sustenance, and an immortal olive tree. I have lived on the land long before swords turn man into prey. I belong there. When heaven mourns for her mother, I return heaven to her mother. And I cry so that a returning cloud might carry my tears. To break the rules, I have learned all the words needed for a trial by blood. I have learned and dismantled all the words in order to draw from them a single word, home. And from Yehuda Amichai, who was born in 1924 in Würzburg, Germany, and this one is translated by the great translator Hannah Block, and it's called An Arab Shepherd is Searching for His Goat on Mount Zion. An Arab shepherd is searching for his goat on Mount Zion, and on the opposite hill I'm searching for my little boy. An Arab shepherd and a Jewish father, both in their temporary failure. Our two voices met above the Sultan's pool in the valley between us. Neither of us wants the boy or the goat to get caught in the wheels of the Had Gadya machine. Afterward, we found them among the bushes, and our voices came back inside us, laughing and crying. Searching for a goat or for a child has always been the beginning of a new religion in these mountains. Thank you so much, and let's welcome Amy Willens and Ben Ehrenreich. Thank you.
Yeah. Normally, we wouldn't have this here. It's my foot's resting place. So Ben and I were talking before we came out here, and he has a section of the book he'd like to read just to get us into the conversation. And he'll probably read a couple more as we go along. This one is particularly beautiful and another moment of absurdity in what is a very absurd and difficult situation. So, Ben, go ahead.
Thank you, Amy. So this needs a tiny bit of introduction, which is just to say this is about a family. Bassem and Nariman Tamimi are the parents and their three children, who are, all of them, the kids as well, are active in the resistance movement in the village called Nabi Saleh, just outside of Ramallah, where every Friday they stage a protest against the Israeli occupation. Every Friday are beaten back by the Israeli Defense Forces. And the only other thing I need to say about it, I think, is that this is focused on the sea. And it's very hard to overstate how much, how large a role the sea plays in people's imagination in the West Bank. You know, since the Second Intifada, most Palestinians in the West Bank have not been able to cross into Israel and therefore to the sea, although they can see it from most high points in the West Bank. You can see the sea sparkling. And children especially talk about it constantly, think about it constantly, because most kids have never been there at all. So I'll read. All week, Nariman said, Abu Yazan had been talking about nothing but the coastal city of Acre and the sea. He had never seen the open water, never swam in it, never heard the rhythm of the waves rolling in. In school, his class had studied Acre, with its ancient citadel and old crusader walls rising from the blue Mediterranean. Abu Yazan wanted to dive from their heights into the water below. He had seen photos, had heard his mother sing Acre's praises. You haven't lived, she once told me, until you've seen Acre. It was barely a couple of hours' drive away, but it had been 15 years since she and Bassem had been able to cross into Israel to make the trip. Before that, they had only been there once, in the first year of their marriage, with Bushra and Naji. We all just cried, Nariman said, at the beauty of the places that had been lost to them. But it was Ramadan, and every Friday the Israeli authorities were allowing some West Bank Palestinians, women and girls, plus men over 40 and boys under 17, to cross through Kalandia checkpoint into Jerusalem to pray at the Al-Aqsa. I met the Tamimis near the East Jerusalem bus station with three Israeli friends. The kids were almost frantic with excitement. They had skipped the mosque and that week's demonstration in the village. We were going to the beach. Ahid withdrew into her iPhone as soon as we got in the car, but her little brother's eyes took in every vehicle we passed and every detail of the landscape, much tamer here than in the rocky hills of the West Bank. I could almost hear Abu Yazan's brain buzzing from the back seat. He asked his mother if it was true that Napoleon couldn't conquer Acre because the city's fortifications were so strong. She told him that it was. Then how did the Jews take it? They didn't, Nariman said. I don't understand how we just gave it away. The highway widened to six lanes. Hey, Abu Yazan yelled. I see the sea. He didn't really. We were still miles from the coast. Abu Yazan spotted a sign for the turnoff to Nazareth. Is there a sea in Nazareth? He asked. We passed the domed concrete silos of a power plant, and then Haifa was in front of us. Not the sea yet, but the shipyards and the train yards and the rear slope of Mount Carmel. Then there it was, the sea, big and blue between the buildings of the port. Everyone was quiet. How beautiful our country is, said Nariman. This isn't our country, Abu Yazan said. Then whose is it? It's the army's country. But the kids would have to wait. We went first to the Baha'i gardens with their palm trees and groomed hedges and flowers spilling in terraced cascades down the western slope of Mount Carmel. Wad took photos of the flowers. Abu Yazan climbed everything that could be climbed. The sea gleamed beneath us in the distance. We headed for the cars. Bassem wanted to drop in on a friend. It was too much for Abu Yazan. He couldn't wait another moment. He howled and made a break for it, running into traffic. I darted after him and carried him squirming to the car. Eventually, we drove north to Acre. Abu Yazan raced up the stone steps of the seawall, scrambled over the rocks beyond the guardrail, and leaned out over the edge to watch the surf crash in below. I had to catch him by his shirt. We walked beneath the ancient arches of the old city and through its narrow alleys. It was 95 degrees and humid. The children ran screaming through the streets, splashing one another with bottled water, their shouts echoing off the thick stone walls. We watched the local kids jump from the seawall into the water 30 feet below. Wad and Abu Yazan peeled off their t-shirts and dared each other to make the leap, but in the end, they didn't do it, which was just as well, because neither of them could swim. It was nearly 6 by the time we made it to the beach. The sun was still hot. It wasn't much of a beach, just a narrow strip of shore wedged between a row of 4-story Soviet-style apartment blocks and the sea. The sand was flecked with colorful shreds and shards of plastic, surf-degraded shopping bags, and random junk in blue and green and pink. Before I stepped out of the car, the kids had bolted for the water. Bassem sat in the shallows and let the waves tickle his bare feet. Nariman lay on a blanket with the others. Abu Yazan, who had waded to the far end of the beach, was screaming. "A fish!" he yelled. "A fish!" I swam over, expecting whatever it was to be gone by the time I reached him. But the fish was still there, about 6 inches long and very dead, lolling with the current. Abu Yazan reached to grab it, got scared, and pulled his hand away. I told him not to touch it, but Salam waded over, picked it up with a drifting shred of plastic bag, and ran off to show his mother, swinging the fish by its tail. The sun sank, and the water turned white, and then gold, and then gray and flat, as the sun disappeared behind the clouds. Bassem and Nariman walked alone down the shore. I had never seen them hold hands before. The sun was gone. Everyone else on the beach had left. The kids were in the water, shrieking and splashing and paddling about. It was dark by the time they slumped back to the cars, wet towels on their pale, skinny shoulders, shivering a little and smiling still.
So I also lived in this part of the world for a while, not to give it a name, because I don't want to give it a name, but I lived on the other side, and I'm just realizing how we took the kids to the beach all the time. We lived in West Jerusalem, there's no problem, we just went to the beach. And I never really, and this is probably how Israelis think, I never even really thought about how hard it was for Palestinians to get to the beach. And then we'd go to Gaza, where you could go, and they had a huge beach that was, just as you described the beach at Accra, sort of closed off and not cared for.
Although when you were there, people could still go from the West Bank to the beach.
They could, but they didn't.
Yeah.
You didn't see people on the beaches of Tel Aviv not very much. So I've thought a lot about Ben's book, of course, because I knew I was doing this, and also because it strikes very near to my heart. I wrote this book a long time ago, Martyr's Crossing, which is a novel about the same kind of problems, but in easier days, I would say, slightly easier days. And when I published it, it got one review that I really remember because I thought it was so awful. I recently reread it. It wasn't that bad. But the one thing it said, I was reminded of it by Ben's book, because one thing that it said was, the problem in this novel is people don't really care about politics that much. They don't live every minute trying to defend their deepest values. They have, smaller concerns. And of course, this was true. They did have smaller concerns, and those are covered in Ben's book. But I want to hear what Ben thinks about that idea that people don't live every day in politics, because one of the things about this book is you see people living every day their political beliefs.
Although, that's partly due to the people that I ended up spending time with, because certainly at least in Ramallah, which is functions as a kind of bubble, which is separated a lot from the rest of the West Bank and the realities of the occupation, people go to the gym and they go shopping and they hang out with their families and they do remove themselves from, I think that's what Ramallah functions as a zone in which people can remove themselves from politics. But I was drawn to the ones who were, most in the thick of it. And most of them, I think, probably didn't want to be. And I think most of us don't want to be
drawn into
about politics all the time. Yeah. And you know, I'm probably drawn to those people because I grew up in a family that was talking about politics all the time. It was always a part of my life. And unfortunately, I think in this country at this particular moment, this seems to be changing. That it's like the worse things get, the more people don't have a choice but to think about, you know, their societies and their place in them, and to be forced to fight, you know, whatever battles they think are important to fight.
Right. So if every day you're confronted with a situation that is untenable for you and your children's future, you're much more likely to be drawn into it.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
But so that's why I consider Ben's book a vindication of my book, because everybody's doing politics all the time. Of course, one reason...
Take that, reviewer.
Right. I'm going to send it to her. One reason a reporter ends up with these kinds of people is that's where the story is. So they're the kind of people that one wants to follow. And I wondered in that, guys, you know, Ben writes a lot about this town. Would you call it a town or a village? Nabi
village
Saleh.
Village is tiny.
A village called Nabi Saleh. He ends up with this family, the Tamimi family. And talk a little bit about how you found them and why you chose them to write about.
Yeah, I found them sort of by accident. The first time I went to Ramallah was in March of 2011. And the day that I happened to arrive was the day of these coordinated demonstrations in the West Bank and Gaza, which the people who organized them, I think, were hoping that they would become the Tahrir Square of Palestine, that they would spring. And they didn't, obviously, and were most of the protesters I watched be very badly beaten by Palestinian Authority security forces that night. But one of the people who was introduced to me that night was Bassem Tamimi. And at the time, he was in hiding. He was unable to go back to the village because soldiers had come for him, had come to his house looking for him, and he knew he'd been arrested if he... went back to the village, and shortly after we met that night and then had coffee, and I interviewed him a few days later in Ramallah. And later that week, he did try to go back to the village.
And you write about this in the book.
I wrote about this in the book. He joked, like, what am I, Osama bin Laden, that if I go back to the village, they're going to notice? So he got in a friend's car, and he kind of hunkered down in the car so he wouldn't be seen by the soldiers as he drove past because the soldiers have a tower at the entrance to the village. And he snuck back into his house, and within 15 minutes of his arrival, dozens of soldiers show up and arrested him. I think he spent the next 11 months in prison.
For what reason? Just curious.
That time, I don't believe... He was spent several times in prison. I'm not sure which charges were which time. Mm-hmm. There were an array of charges brought against him. Everything from basically they were able to charge him with leading the village protests, with taking part in illegal demonstrations, because in the West Bank under Israeli military law, to any protest, I think it's more than 10 people that doesn't have the permission of the military authorities
is
an illegal protest. So he was.
And they did that every Friday.
Yeah, they did it every Friday, beginning in 2009. And there it was in reaction to a spring in the village, that word again.
Right, which is the title of the book.
Yeah.
The Weight of the Spring.
That had been taken by the settlers in the community adjacent to theirs was a settlement named Halamish, which was built largely on land that had been taken from Palestinians in Nabi Saleh and was sort of slowly expanding, as most settlements do. And at one point, they took this spring, which wasn't a fundamental water source for the village. It was just sort of one step too far, and the villagers began marching every Friday to try to get to the spring. And since then, that was in December of 2009, they've made it to the spring once. I was there that day, but for the every time except for that one time when the soldiers, for whatever reason, weren't paying attention, the soldiers fire tear gas and rubber-coated bullets and occasionally live bullets, and they don't make it to
the
spring.
Couldn't get down there, right?
But that was really what drew me to them, that they kept going back every Friday, despite the enormous costs.
And this family, the Tamimis, are a big family there, right?
Yeah.
So that's lots of people, cousins.
Yeah, the whole village, yeah, almost everyone in the village, right, is a Tamimi. It's the whole, you know, village is one.
So once you've got one in your story, you've got 20. Which, and indeed,
yes,
there are basically 8 or 9 of them who are covered in the book.
Which means that I have to make the decision to use first names
for almost
everyone in the book.
Because everyone has the same last name. So I wanted to talk a little bit about something I've thought a lot about, having covered both sides of the Green Line, which is the romance of Palestine. You talk about it in the introduction to the book, and there is this sort of romance of the Arab world in general, and the romance of the oppressed people, too. And I remember very well something I've talked a lot with my family about, this old Israeli woman we knew when we lived in Jerusalem, who would say, "Oh, you reporters," she'd say, you love them in their robes with their tea, and they invite you in. They're so hospitable. And what are we? Look what we look like. We look just like you. So you're not interested in us." So that was her feeling about how the reporters were seduced. But I wanted you to talk a little bit about what it was. You say that Palestine has a tendency to enchant people.
Yeah. And I think a lot of it is, I know for me, and I would see the same thing happen, because there's a lot of foreigners who come through, yeah, both journalists.
And you saw them all the time.
I saw them all the time. And you see kind of new batches coming. They cycle through. If you stay long enough, you see them come and you see them,
right,
go. But also a lot of activists, a lot of solidarity activists come. And both for the activists and for a lot of journalists, even journalists who went in without strong political feelings, I would see them quickly transformed, usually in the first week that they were there. They might go in having read American papers or, you know, European media and have a sense that this was this complicated, thorny, difficult topic, and both sides had, you know, sort of equal points and they were there to sort it all out. And within a few days, they were like, "Oh my God." And this sort of astounding, painful moral clarity kind of fell on them. Because the difference in power is so astounding, is so deep, and the overwhelming power that the Israeli military exerts in the West Bank, and its cruelties and its manifold absurdities just blow you away, and they certainly blew me away. I think for me, the romance of it was not the hospitality of Arab life or any of those things, but was the romance of struggle. And I think that's true for a lot of others also, that people keep fighting, and you think, how can they win? They can't win. This army is so, you know, overwhelmingly powerful, and they're beaten and they're beaten and they're killed and they're killed, and they keep at it. And one can only be romantic about that for so long before one's heart is just broken. And so if it was a somewhat romantic interest that drew me there, it wasn't whatever fuzziness hovered over it in the first few months quickly dissipated.
I think one thing is, one thing that happens, and you talk about it a little bit in the book, people come to people like the Tamimis, or to you who are watching the Tamimis, and let that stand for Palestinians, yeah, and say, you know, how can they do this? How can they throw little Ahed Tamimi into these protests day in and day out, every Friday, inculcating in her, you know, this massive feeling of resistance and also of her own oppression. How can they do that? But yet when you see, as you said, the manifest injustice, it's almost like, how can they not, right?
Yeah, and you come to understand the really painful choices that people have to make. I mean, it's something I talked with Bassem and Nariman and with other adults in the
village. Those are the parents of the little kids you saw at the beach.
And if people don't know, Ahed, the little girl who's only mentioned once in that section, is something of a celebrity now.
Yes, she is. I've been all over the internet with Ahed recently.
She's a striking, like, beautiful little girl with, like, long blonde hair.
She's pre-Raphaelite.
Yes, that's it. She became tragically famous in, I think it was 2013, when her older brother was arrested for the first time and soldiers had just arrested him and put him into an Israeli armored car. And she lost it because they'd taken her brother away, and was captured on film, shaking her tiny little fist in the face of an armored Israeli soldier. And that image went viral and sort of came to stand for a lot of people for the courage of right. the Palestinian struggle. But you know, for this kid, it's awful. Like she, you know, it wasn't a nice moment. She won't remember that well. As brave as she was, nobody should have to be that brave when they're that age. As I was saying, I think the dilemma, which is really hard to understand from here, and that I talked with her parents about a lot, was what do we do? If we don't teach our children to fight, that you know they will learn to cower. If we keep our children inside while all this is happening. Like, what kind of model will we, you know...
Right.
And they're not safe inside anyway. Even if we keep them inside, the soldiers will come inside. The tear gas will come inside. So how do we teach our children to be brave? And then we take them with us.
But yet there's that great moment where they say, or where someone is commenting in the book, we teach them to be brave because we don't really have another choice. But then how do you tell a brave 10-year-old who just shook her fist at an Israeli soldier, it's time for bed?
Yeah.
Sorry, honey, it's time for bed. It's a little difficult.
These were spirited children.
There's some great stuff on the internet about Ahed. You know, so she was taken, this kid who really did this very brave thing, and very reflexively, it wasn't like thought out. She was then taken and toured around the world to various places where people wanted to show this brave Palestinian kid. And there's one clip on the internet that it just shows what celebrity does, and since we're in L.A., I thought I'd mention it. So Ahed, who's done this brave thing and several other very brave things, there's a moment where there's some kind of a videographer there, and she goes up to an Israeli soldier. She's just incredibly cute and strong. And she looks over at the videographer. He's a little too far away. And when he gets close, then. Because she's learned about how it works. You know, it was amazing to see. But she's really great. Amazing person. I wanted to talk a little bit about your cabinet of curiosities. Mm-hmm. I love these things. You know, this is a very harsh book in a way. I mean, it's really beautiful. I think it's hugely important. I hope everybody buys it and everybody reads it, and not just in this room where maybe there's a certain like-mindedness, but among people who might not be as open to this book, because I think it's a politically important book. But it's very harsh, and I think, therefore, or anyway, Ben has interspersed little sort of portraits of situations on the West Bank, and he calls them interludes and the cabinet of curiosities of the occupation. And I thought maybe you should talk about Kalandia mm-hmm. and how it works. This is the Kalandia checkpoint, and about the humiliation machine.
Yeah. You know, the more time I spent there, I think when I first started going there, there was a lot I couldn't understand, but I sort of thought it was all rational. Mm-hmm. You know, you build a wall, you don't want people to cross, something like this. But the more time I spent there, the more those rationales didn't make any sense, and the more it became clear that there was another logic at work. And some of these interludes are places of extraordinary absurdity.
Like Honey, the Nation of Honey.
Of Honeyama, yeah. Yeah. So the first one, which some of you might have seen, it was excerpted in The Nation, is about a guy who lives in a village called Masha, which is fairly near the Green Line, not on the Green Line. The wall... was scheduled to go right through his house. And it ended up crossing between his house and the village in which he lived. So on one side of his house is the wall. If you look out his front windows, you see an 8-meter-high concrete wall. And behind his house are the fences separating his house from the settlement. So he's just separated off completely from his village and unable to go. So, you know, he's been, you know, entirely isolated. There's another one about another house which had a wall built specially around it. This one was it was fencing. It wasn't concrete, but it has, like, you know, 20-foot-high fencing down a driveway, and then the fence just surrounds this one house.
And doesn't he have to buzz himself out to the checkpoint or something?
They won this battle, but when they first built that, because basically the settlers wanted his land, and he refused to leave. So they said, fine, we'll wall you off. So they built a wall around him, and at first they put up a gate, and the gate was always closed, and if he wanted to come or go, or if anyone wanted to visit him, he would have to go out and press a button in an intercom, and the intercom was connected to an Israeli border police post like 8 kilometers away, and he'd have to press it and then wait.
Until they picked up.
And if he missed it, then he'd have to start over. And sometimes they would pick up in a few minutes, sometimes they would pick up a few hours later, and he'd have to wait. And then they would, you know, eventually, hopefully, buzz him through. Unless they were mad at him for one reason or another, in which case they just wouldn't, you know, open at all, and he went as long as a month not being able to leave his home. So there are these you know, manifest absurdities, and which are impossible to understand through any, you know, rational logic of security. And then Kalandia checkpoint is certainly one of those places. And I don't know if anyone has had the good fortune to be able to pass through Kalandia, but you hear checkpoint.
It wasn't even there when I lived there.
Yeah, it was built slowly during the Second Intifada. First as just a soldier's post on the road where cars were stopped, and then it sort of grew and grew and grew and kind of metastasized. And it's been a site, especially in the last 6 months, of, you know, many killings. There are constant clashes at the checkpoint. And it's the main checkpoint between Ramallah and Jerusalem. So I was frequently driving between those cities, which meant I had to get used to driving through the clashes. And everyone's used to it. So, like, the guys who take part in the clashes, and clashes usually means, like, young men throwing rocks at the checkpoint and the soldiers shooting at the young men with rubber-coated bullets and sometimes real bullets and tear gas. But, you know, the guys would take turns throwing rocks and then come back to direct traffic.
Right.
You know, because it was normal. But the really impressive part of Kalandia is actually the pedestrian crossing, where you walk through a series of cages, of very narrow cages. And particularly in the mornings when a lot of people who live on the Ramallah side have to go into Jerusalem for work, it gets incredibly crowded.
And they're human size. They're like the size of you.
The size of like a thin person.
A thinnish person,
And so if there's a lot of people, you're all packed up against each other. You're all smelling each other and touching each other and getting annoyed with each other. And then you pass through a series of turnstiles, which are like the big New York City subways.
The slicers.
Yeah. And I think in Kalandia there's also the small kind of like library style turnstiles.
The push, waist push.
But the ones at Kalandia, the arms they're specially made for checkpoints, and the arms are 25% shorter than the ones they have in Israel. Because in Israel, they have these to get into shopping malls or to get into any public place where they stop you to pat you down. But they make them smaller for Palestinians, which has a supposed security function, but also it just means it's more humiliating. And you go through this series of kind of cattle cages until you're finally released into a cage surrounded by other cages where there's a soldier behind bulletproof glass who kind of barks at you through a PA system, sort of crackly Hebrew that, you know, most people can't understand anyway, and you couldn't understand even if you were fluent.
I'm sure there are some people out here who are saying this sounds like the TSA, but it's a lot worse.
It's a little worse.
It's a lot worse.
And then you have to show your ID. There are biometric for people who have a permit. They put their hand in the little biometric device, you have to remove whatever items of clothing they ask you to remove, which sometimes means like your shoes, even if it's wet and raining and the ground is filthy. And what this means is that every day, for people who are making this crossing every day, there is this ritual humiliation.
And how long is that wait? It's usually hours long, right?
It depends. You know, I mean, if you do it at a calm time, it'll take you 15 minutes. But it can easily also be hours. And you don't know. And that's part of the.
So what is the underlying logic that you believe you've figured out? Why the Israelis do it? What is it? What is the point it's making?
I think there, Kalandia and a number of other things around the West Bank that people experience just constantly, including that uncertainty, you know, that you don't know if it's going to take 15 minutes or 3 hours. They induce despair. They very meticulously induce despair. And I think that is the plan.
But doesn't despair make people do irrational, violent things rather than reduce them to,
Yeah, it's a bad plan.
It's a plan
that doesn't work.
Yeah.
And that actually, meticulously produces violence.
Right.
Because I think there's a calculation at work that if you kind of keep people pushed down enough, they won't fight back. But I think the truth is that if you keep people pushed down enough, they lose their fear. And they
lash
out.
That's what the book seems to show over and over. Another thing that's so great about Ben's book is that, I haven't read a lot of reporters writing from within that cage. So you get a lot of reporters who meet Palestinians at the checkpoint where they go through, but not that many people who actually stand with the people and go through. And I really admired that as a way of reporting and a way of understanding what must be the feelings people would have who had to do that all the time. Again, I remember when I wrote my book, a lot of Palestinians said, oh, it's good, but you don't really show what it's like at the checkpoint. The checkpoint is so horrible. You don't have enough of checkpoints in there. And I didn't really know because I didn't really spend my time going through, but you did it, and it really is powerful. I thought one of the most beautiful sections in the book, and there are so many really beautiful sections in a book that is really very tough, is the section where you stay with the shepherds of Al-Kher, an even smaller village on the West Bank that is suffering from the occupation, but at the time you were there had not yet been entirely subsumed and by the occupation or by the settlers of Carmel. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit about one of my favorite of the many Kafkaesque stories in your book, about the Goldstein family and the shepherd's dung oven and the fate of the dung oven. It's a little bit like the spring, but it's somehow richer to me.
Yeah, I mean, the guys in Umulher would actually laugh when they would take me to the oven. Umulher is this tiny, tiny, 50 to 100 people, Bedouin village in the South Hebron Hills, which, if you don't know it, is the poorest, driest, most sparsely populated part of the West Bank. It's really at the northern reach of the Negev Desert. It's also very beautiful. I mean, rolling, dry hills. And most of the Palestinians who live there are Bedouins who were expelled from the Negev inside of Israel after 1948 and into the 1950s. And Umulher was founded by a family that left their ancestral homes in what is now Israel and bought the land on this hilltop. And in 1976 or 7, I forget the year exactly, settlers arrived and decided that this would also be a nice place for a settlement, and their troubles began again, which has meant constant demolition orders, demolitions, but a lot of the friction was focused around, for years, around this one oven. And the people there are very poor, and they basically eat bread and sheep and goat's milk and occasional meat and vegetables. But bread is a really big part of their diet, and they have these very crude ovens. It's called a taboon, which is there. The fuel is actually goat shit.
Dung, I like to call
dung.
It.
Dung, we can call it dung. But no one can afford to pay for charcoal or for wood or for gas, but they have this natural source.
And they've done it for centuries.
Yeah. And basically, you wouldn't even recognize it as an oven. It's just this sort of lump with some tarps on top of it. And they kind of have to feed it dung once a day, and twice a day, the women of the village go there and make bread. And it creates just a little bit of smoke, not more than like...
Because secretly, dung is really efficient.
Yeah, yeah.
Remember that.
Turns out. We might need this. It's kind of like your neighbor is having a barbecue. That's how much smoke it produces. But the settlers across the way, and the settlement of Carmel is extremely close. So the closest buildings in Carmel are about the distance of that wall to me, to where this oven is. And this one couple brought the people of Umlachair to court for the nuisance of this oven, because it was apparently driving them mad. They claimed it was giving their children asthma, et cetera, and you know, dozens of journalists have come to look at the oven. Various diplomats have come to look at the oven. Like heads of NGOs have come.
You can imagine
the oven.
Them peering. It's like this big, right? It's not much bigger, is it?
A little bigger, but not much. Yeah. It's not an impressive sight. Like I tried to photograph it a few times, but it doesn't make for good photography. And then every now and again the Israeli army would come and a bunch of soldiers would, you know, well-armed soldiers would photograph it and stare at it and write notes about it. And then eventually it was actually after, I guess it makes it into the epilogue of this book, it was demolished in a round of demolitions in the village in, I think it was in October of 2014.
Did they build a new one?
They did not rebuild the oven. They decided that they have there's another oven on the other side of the village, so they're using that one. And they decided it was just too much trouble to keep
to bother the gold
settlers. Yeah. Umlachair, I saw just today, got another round of demolition orders. Since I finished the book, there have twice been demolitions in the village. On both occasions, six homes were destroyed.
Can I say there aren't that many homes?
No.
Like six homes is a lot of homes for Umlachair.
Yeah.
I wanted to read, if you don't mind, Ben, just a tiny section after you talk about the oven. I don't doubt that the Goldsteins, who according to their complaint moved to Carmel in 2008, were sincere in their hatred of that oven, but it produced very little smoke. I was almost always closer to the oven than the Goldsteins, and I occasionally noticed a sharp and slightly bitter odor. It was hardly noxious and no more damaging than your fireplace a few doors down, but I can imagine that it might drive certain settlers mad, that it might lodge in their nostrils and never leave. The stink not just of smoke, but of poverty and stubbornness, of a relation to this land that predated them, a way of living that challenged the brittle, fearful tidiness of the suburban order that Israel was attempting to impose on these rough hills. Mainly, the oven smoke smelled of other people, others whom the settlers could not understand and did not wish to, and who refused consistently and with a willfulness that must have been infuriating to just die or go away. Thought that was great. Wish I'd written it. One of your greatest characters is Eid Suleiman Al-Hatalin from Umlachair also. He's a Palestinian artist who makes, unaccountably, he makes small replicas of the diggers and dumpsters that clear the land for Israeli settlements, so like mini caterpillars. And he makes them with this loving attention to detail. And he claims, and I think you believe him, and I believe him, no political motivation whatsoever. He's kind of a prophet and a holy man in your book. You want to talk about him a little bit?
Yeah, so he makes these amazing sculptures out of trash. I mean, he picks up little scraps of plastic and CDs and pieces of license plates, and he makes these amazing sculptures. And when I first met him, I thought, like, clearly this was there was something ironic
commentary,
and kind of
right.
arch about his work. But it later became clear he loves these machines. And we're Facebook friends. He posts images of bulldozers and whatnot on the new model of whatever John Deere tractor is out, because he just loves these machines. And he's a He was first introduced to me by an Israeli activist named Ezra Nawi, who said we went out of our way to Umlachair, and he said, "You're going to love Eid. He's not he doesn't belong on this earth." He doesn't belong, certainly, in this place. And I didn't know what he meant until I met Eid. And it's hard to imagine a more rugged landscape than the South Hebron Hills, both in terms of like the actual geography, the poverty, the tension between Palestinians and the settlers, because the settlers in the South Hebron Hills are among the more difficult and aggressive characters one finds. And Eid is this, he's a vegetarian, which is...
unheard of.
Doesn't happen in herding communities very much. He's a religious man, but he's fairly heretical in his in ways that I find really appealing. I mean, he talks about, you know, he really admires the Buddha.
Oh yeah, I love that.
And just has a fascinating mind. So he was. He was one of the things that kept drawing me back to Umm al-Khair. And it was always, however difficult things were, it was always a great relief to spend time with Eid. It's very easy being there to get caught up in the constant ferment and the rage and the violence.
Right.
And Eid would just sort of like, with a few words, just poke through all of that and remind you of something very basically human.
More profound.
Yeah.
Do you want to read that section?
Sure. It's a little bit of a longer section. And I think the only thing you need to know about it that we haven't already said is that Eid worked. Most people in Umm al-Khair either worked with their flocks or would work illegally for the most part inside Israel, doing construction or working in the fields. But Eid had a job with an NGO that did... like mine clearance work, that he would search the hills for unexploded munitions dropped by the Israeli military. We were at the birthday party for Eid's daughter Lynn when his phone rang. It was a farmer named Ibrahim who was harvesting wheat just outside the village with his son. Something had fallen from an F-16, he said, and landed in their field. It was a short walk. The farmers who had come from Yatta to work the land put down their scythes and showed Eid what they had found, a heavy rectangular object wrapped in shiny foil and dented at one end. A sticker in Hebrew had survived the fall. Flammable material, it read. Eid didn't think it was dangerous. He photographed it anyway and logged the location on a yellow GPS reader. The farmers went back to their work, and Eid and I sat on a low stone wall. The conversation turned to animals, their genius and their strength, our blindness beside the power of their senses. You know, the camel can crush a car, Eid said. If you make it angry, oh God, it will kill you. And of course there were giraffes. What a miracle of an animal, Eid said. Her legs are so long. Yes, my friend, he sighed. That is it. So easy, so hard. It was something he said often, a refrain he repeated, almost a tick. I thought about it later, lying awake on the cistern, staring up at the maze of the stars and at Mars glowing red in the sky. I remembered a Dostoevsky story called The Dream of a Ridiculous Man. Walking home one gloomy evening, Dostoevsky's protagonist saw a bright star between the clouds and resolved to end his life that very night. But he fell asleep, his revolver on the table beside him, and dreamed that he had shot himself, and in death traveled to the star he had seen and found a planet there, like Earth, but undefiled by the fall. Its people knew neither cruelty nor grasping, only a love increased as if to the point of rapture, but a rapture that was calm. And the protagonist, freed from his despair, saw how beautiful life could be, how simple it was to love. Of course, it didn't work out. It was a Dostoevsky story. Without meaning to, the story's protagonist brought corruption with him. In jest or in flirtation, he told one small lie, and lies soon spread, and cruelty was born from them, and bloodshed and shame. There began the struggle for separation, for isolation, for mine and thine. No sooner had people turned on one another than they began talking of brotherhood and humanity, and no sooner had they discovered crime than they invented justice and drew up whole codes of law. The protagonist awoke from his dream and resolved to devote his life to preaching, to telling everyone he could of the truth he had witnessed. His message was not so different from Eid's. that people can be happy and beautiful without losing their ability to live on earth, that all they have to do is love. That is the main thing, and that is everything. So easy, my friend, so hard. And that, I realized, was why the others regarded Ede with such gentle admiration, no matter how heretical or nonsensical they found his views. It wasn't just his art or his intelligence that made him special. It was that something had stayed alive in him that had died or gone dormant in the rest of us, something delicate and perhaps even sacred. And though we could no longer always find it in ourselves, we could recognize it in Ede, could see its beauty and its truth, and also the pain that it caused him. Behind us, on the far side of the fence, three soldiers loitered outside their quarters. One of them walked off on patrol, not bothering to wear his helmet. And Ede talked about torture in the prisons of the Arab world, and the fear that prevented him from going to pray at the Al-Aqsa, and the possibility of Judgment Day. "I believe in that," he said, though he didn't think it would happen soon. We talked about climate change and the war in Ukraine. "Bad world," Ede said. "Everything is going to be a problem." We talked about his first time on a plane and the city of Cambridge, which he had loved, and the fanatical settlers of Yitzhar. "A lot of crazy things in this world," Ede observed. "Where there are bad things, you find the good things, actually. For instance, there was a settler who lived in Carmel, the son of a Holocaust survivor. His name was Roan. He had called Ede to apologize the last time the army demolished homes in the village. He's a very good man, actually," Ede said. He didn't speak to him often because the other settlers would cause trouble for him if they saw him fraternizing with Arabs. "But in my mind," Ede said, "he's a friend of mine. I'm not concerned with geography, whether it's an illegal settlement or not. I'm concerned with finding good men. Even the bad men," and Ede acknowledged that there were some of those, "he didn't want to see them hurt. It pained him," he told me, "whenever he heard that a settler had been shot. The man's family would suffer, and so would whoever shot him, whether they were captured or not. The wheel of vengeance would keep on spinning and dragging everyone along." "I think this land is very big," Ede said. "It can take all of us without any problems. But because we are humans, we are stupid, and we do not see the truth. We do not want to speak to our neighbors, and there is misunderstanding between us." I was about to reply that he made it sound too simple, that good people did ugly things all over the world, and it was rarely a question of individuals and their choices or emotions, but of systems, machines that were larger than any of us. But Ede beat me to it and said it again, his refrain. "It's so easy," he said, "and so hard." He talked about other friends, Israeli friends whom he used to see but didn't anymore, Eyal from Beersheba, with whom he used to do Tai Chi, and another friend, really a very good man, who lived in Sderot, just outside of Gaza, who had to deal not only with the rockets falling, but with the anger of his neighbors who didn't like it that he had Palestinian friends, until finally he moved his family to America because he didn't want his children to grow up around such hate. And another friend, a very good friend, who had moved to the U.S., who had moved to the U.S. too so that her son would never have to be a soldier. "Yes," Ede said, "they all moved away, and he was always sad when they did. But of course they moved," he said. "Everyone wants to go." I didn't mention that most of the people in the village wanted only to stay.
Beautiful.
Thank you.
It's beautiful, but what does it mean? What lesson do you take from that? Is love, would love conquer all if we could just love each other? I mean, isn't that a little, that's a little simple, right?
You know, I mean, the Dostoevsky story is called Dream of the Ridiculous Man because
it's ridiculous.
Because he's this, to shout in this world, in this broken, you know, world, to shout all you need is love,
right,
makes you a lunatic. But I don't think that makes it any less true.
Yeah, it just seems, I mean, so Ben's book takes place largely, as you can see, in the occupied territories and not on the other side of the line. But where the settlers do come into it, you can see there's not a lot of love lost between the settlers and the Palestinians on either side, right? Ben fairly understands that the settlers, one thing about them that makes them kind of a weird mirror image of the Palestinians is that they super believe in what they're doing. But it's not a nice behavior that that they're up to. And I think that's one of the things that makes it so hard to, like, even begin to consider a Christian kind of love in the midst of this very stark situation. And I didn't see in your book a lot of hope. And one of the things that really stood out to me, you know, I've been wavering on the two-state versus the one-state solution. One state I'm not that mad about because as a Jew, I realized that the majority is not going to be Jewish anymore if there's a one-state solution and what will happen. But then two-state seems absolutely inconceivable at this point. And from reading this book, I really, I felt that there couldn't be a two-state solution. And I began to think, well, Ben is a lot like Netanyahu. I bet no one said that to you.
No one's ever said that, no.
But, so what do you think about that?
We do share a name.
What do you think about that? I think after reading your book, it will be very hard for people to ever consider. At the beginning of the book, you say peace, in talking about the Oslo Accords, peace was a code for a sneaky sort of war, and all the Palestinians know this. So I guess at the end of this, because I think we have to open it up to you all soon, I just want to know, what do you see as a future? I know this is the most annoying question you can ask a reporter and a serious writer of nonfiction, but, and I don't expect you to be prescriptive, but just what do you think? What do you think can be a future there, if any?
I mean, it's a question I end up being asked a lot. And
I bet.
Yeah, I don't see any real hope for the two-state solution. I think there's now 500,000 Israeli settlers in the West Bank and East Jerusalem. That's a lot of people.
Hard to call back.
And they are not folks who would leave easily. And it's inconceivable in the current Israeli political landscape for any politician to even talk about pulling them out. Even talk about pulling some of them out is inconceivable.
Right.
Things have just moved so far to the right that it would be political suicide for any Israeli politician to do that. They're so thoroughly, you know, it's 500,000 people. It's a lot of people. They're not going to go easily. They've been expanding for decades. They are continuing to expand. So I don't see how any kind of two-state solution could be made at this point that wouldn't reduce the West Bank to a sort of archipelago of tiny Palestinian enclaves, which is what is happening.
But that's what's happening.
Which is what's happening anyway. It would just be formalized with a state.
So will it take, say, another century, and then Israel will have pushed all of these people out? Basically?
I will not make predictions.
You will not make predictions.
I will not make predictions.
Much as I try to make you make predictions.
Or even prescriptions, except one. You know, I think as Americans, we tend to think, like, how can we fix this? Like, what's the solution?
Right.
And I think that kind of thinking has gotten us in a huge amount of trouble in the Middle East, not just in this region.
Right.
But Americans with ideas for solutions tend to create big messes.
Yes.
And I think that if we want to ask ourselves what we can do, there is actually something very concrete we could do, because Americans are not at all passive
outside
bystanders
this.
To
right.
this. You know, our government gives $3.1 billion a year in military aid to Israel.
I kept thinking each time someone would fire a shot at an 18-year-old Palestinian stone thrower, I thought, I paid for it.
Yeah, and I can't tell you how many times Palestinians have shown me the lettering on tear gas canisters that says made in USA.
Right.
And so, I mean, I think there is apparently even talk of John Kerry starting up this process again, which I think would be, you know, utterly foolish.
The peace process.
The peace process. And what I think the U.S. can do, and what the U.S. government ought to, every time that the rest of the world tries to be critical in some international body of some latest infamy committed by the Israeli military, some latest flagrant breach of international law, it is the U.S. that exercises its veto power. The Obama administration, more consistently than any other administration, despite his personal problems with Netanyahu. And that has to end. I think Israeli governments, whether they're on the left or right, have learned that there will be no consequences aside from a little finger wagging for anything they do from the U.S. The finger will be wagged while the other hand delivers the check.
Right.
And that means that we are not only passive observers, we are participants in this conflict. And we are participants in a grave injustice. And I think we need to demand that our government stop doing that.
So with that, I'm not exactly sure when I'm supposed to start the conversation, but my handlers say now. So we'd love to take questions from the audience. Okay, how about this person right in front of Louise?
Yeah.
Okay, all right, great.
Thank you very much for a very interesting conversation. I remember about 20 years ago hearing the phrase regarding Yasser Arafat that he never misses an opportunity to miss an opportunity. And I was wondering what your experience has been talking to the average Palestinian, how they regard their own leadership, whether it's Yasser Arafat or Mahmoud Abbas, and if they hold them accountable to some extent for the situation they're in.
Well, I should say there's no average Palestinian any more than there's an average American. But I would say that although, you know, Palestinians, like any people, have like widely disparate opinions about everything, most people agree in their opinions about Mahmoud Abbas and the Palestinian Authority. And there's, you know, there's a great deal of disillusion and mistrust for the current leadership. It's complicated because the PA is the largest employer in the West Bank. So a lot of people owe their livelihoods or their families' livelihoods to the PA while at the same time resenting the role that it plays in Palestinian society, which is very much, I think it's easy from here to believe that there are these opponents, the Israeli government and the Palestinian Authority, because we see them engaged in negotiations. But for the most part, the Palestinian Authority does everything it can to prevent any real resistance from taking shape to the occupation. And they're widely resented for this. Arafat, you know, it was Arafat who kind of helped, who signed this system into place with the Oslo agreements. And a lot of Palestinians do a sort of curious
two-step
with regards to Arafat, and he is beloved. You know, he's sort of the father of Palestinian nationalism. His face is in every restaurant and half the homes you go into. And they somehow, although they resent most of the systems he's put in place, reserve some veneration for him despite that.
Yeah, he's like the George Washington of Palestine.
Yeah.
So I'm not choosing anyone, right? Okay.
I don't know if it's a question or a comment, but I do agree that weapons this country has done damage. Sorry. As a kid at the war back home, you said it. You will start to see bullets come from here. And it was sad.
Are you from Salvador?
Yes. Sorry.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah. I think from here and from the comfort that a lot of people live in here, it's very we're very far from the damage that our country does elsewhere, but it's very real. Thank you.
With so many members of Mossad and Shin Bet opposed to Israeli policies and to Netanyahu, why doesn't that have an impact on the Israeli population?
With so many people who serve in the Shin Bet and the Mossad, Israel's two intelligence forces, opposed to the kind of behaviors that Netanyahu is encouraging, why does that not have any effect on the Israeli public?
You know, I think the main I think two reasons, really. One is that I think the main function of the wall that was built beginning in the Second Intifada for Israelis has been to render Palestinian life completely invisible, to completely separate themselves from the people who live on the other side of it. And in the absence of any real contact with them, Netanyahu has been extremely skillful in stoking fear. Right? That's his great strength as a politician. He's good at it. And whenever he needs to, he finds a way to push those buttons again, and people respond. You know, something really strange has happened in the last couple of years, that Israeli society has moved so far to the right, and in a way that's, you know, frequently openly racist in mainstream Israeli politics and media circles, that the voices of reason are often coming from the leadership of the Shin Bet and the military, that the ones who are saying the only things that make sense, such as, like, you know, well, if we, you know, put a closure on this village, people are going to start fighting us. We need to, you know, let go a little bit. If, you know, perhaps the reason for all of these stabbing attacks is that people are frustrated and despairing, et cetera, et cetera. You know, these very rational notions that basically, like, if you squeeze too hard, people fight back. That the only people who are saying this out loud are actually people in the security and intelligence services. And Netanyahu has been fighting back. I mean, this is one of the reasons why he just sacked his defense minister, Yaalon, and replaced him with the far more pugnacious Avigdor Lieberman. Because he was getting pushback from the military.
But another reason that those people say the things they do is because they actually see the Palestinians.
Yeah, yeah. So. I mean, they see them, you know, at the checkpoints, right. Interrogation rooms, et cetera, et cetera.
But they see them.
My question is, how did you meet Irene Nasser? The reason I ask is because I actually went to college at American University with her. Mm-hmm. Didn't really know much about your book, but I saw her name and I was like, that's crazy. And so I guess that question, but how for you, it was asked a little bit earlier, but the difference between an activist and a person who, you know, lives in Palestine and this is a daily occurrence and people just come and visit and back and forth. But what for you is the difference between an activist and a person who actually is living with people and knows people as friends and not just as political actors?
Irene was working for a group called Just Vision when I got there. And one of her jobs was to, part of her job was to show journalists around, introduce them to people in the popular resistance movement. So that's the context we met in. I think the line, you know, there are Palestinians who, just like there are Americans, who sometimes will go to a demonstration and are not really activists. I mean, activists are the folks who it's kind of the center of their lives and whatever else they do for work or whatever else they do in their lives are, you know, singularly devoted to their political activities.
Some Israelis despair of the chances for a two-state solution, but consider that the occupation is destroying the soul of the people and advocate just withdrawing from the occupied territories. Do you think that has any possibility of working?
It's worth a shot.
It's hard to imagine the settlers out there,
yeah.
What would happen to them or what their reaction to that could be extremely violent too, but what do you think?
Yeah, you know, I think it's, you know, withdrawing is not simply a question of pulling troops out because of all the settlements. And not just the settlements, but the infrastructure. I mean, even, you know, in Herzog, the leader of the Zionist Union, which is what we used to call the Labor Party, has been advocating for just a complete separation. This is almost impossible to imagine there now, not only because of the settlements, but like Palestinians are on the Israeli water system because the Israelis don't let the Palestinians use their own water. You know, that the economic lives are completely entwined. So a simple separation is hard to imagine. It's also hard to imagine that it wouldn't also just be completely disastrous for Palestinians if it happened just like that. Does that mean that they just cut water off for Palestinians?
Cut off the water, cut off the cell phone service.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was remembering when Israel unilaterally pulled out of Gaza, mm-hmm. that even that where there were no settlements was kind of a disaster.
Well, it pulled the settlers out.
It had to pull them out, yeah. Right. But there were very few there comparatively, population-wise. Yeah.
And it created extraordinary bitterness and, you know, within Israeli society. Certainly the settler right felt deeply betrayed. And the settler right has not hesitated to, you know, act with violence against
Israelis.
Israeli
army.
Yeah.
And then the whole point of having the settlers out there is so that you can't easily extract yourself from the occupation, or I think.
Yeah.
Could you talk on a personal level of your expectations, your expectations of the book? Late at night, did you fantasize that this would be the Uncle Tom's Cabin, and the depictions that were empathetic would sweep away all the distrust, mistrust, and so on? Or besides being a writer and having to make a living, what were your expectations for the book and the impact of the book?
You know, they were much more... I'm just trying to think of myself in relation to Harriet Beecher Stowe and something like that.
It's a good book. It's not that bad a book.
No, you know, most of my thinking was much more immediate. It was like, you know, like, how do I write about Hebron? Hebron is almost impossible to write about. It's such a, you know, completely bizarre and absurd place. How can I convey in the only language that I have the absurdity of this place? Some of it was questions like that. Some of it were immediate questions of, you know, people that I came to know extremely well and care about. How do I do them justice? How do I represent them in a way that you know, honors them without being absolutely partial? You know, that is honest and allows for criticism, but that still shows them respect as human beings. I mean, it was those were the things that kind of kept me awake at night. You know, how, as a writer, can I pull this off? Can I do justice to the experiences that I've had and the people I've met and what I've seen? And of course, you know, through all that, there's also the hope. Because I think writing about Palestinian life under occupation, for most Americans who haven't made an effort to learn about this, because you really do have to make an effort. If you're not Palestinian, you don't know much about it. So how to represent these realities that most Americans don't have much knowledge of at all, but do have set ideas about this conflict. So how can I, you know, get people to open their hearts to this and open their minds to a different perspective? Those are really the questions that kept me awake.
Thank you, Ben, for putting a voice and a face to people who are struggling against injustice. As an Israeli, I have for many decades been saddened, sometimes outraged, by the fact that my people, who have known so much oppression for centuries and centuries, have somehow in a mythic reversal tried to find out what it is like to be an oppressor of other peoples. But my question has to do with something that may have some political consequence for the future. About 25 years ago, if I remember correctly, Nelson Mandela and de Klerk managed to get rid of apartheid in South Africa, partly because of who they were, but also because there was something called BDS, boycott, divestment, and sanctions against the apartheid regime. That brings me to the current, you know, BDS happening here, particularly in the United States, where both the University of California recently passed a resolution that sort of watered down and demanded that anti-Zionism or anti-Semitism not be allowed. And then we have Governor Cuomo of New York doing the same thing. So my question is, if we have, as the Palestinians seem to want to have now, perhaps a new president, and perhaps Marwan Barghouti, who is now in jail, in an Israeli jail, if he were to become somehow president, do you see some kind of correlation there that might force the Israeli government to change its policies?
I don't think that Marwan Barghouti is going to be president anytime soon. As much as you know, he is beloved. He's one of the few figures that you know, across factional lines, a lot of Palestinian support. But it's hard to imagine that he will be released as Mandela was, that Israel would allow that to happen. What hope I do have for change doesn't start in Israel, because I think things are quite bad now, and it's not in the Palestinian side either, because things are quite fragmented and atomized, and there's just not much movement. The developments that you're talking about, Cuomo's executive order, the UC Regents decision, New Jersey also just passed a law against BDS a couple of days ago. All of this, I think, these are signs of successes. You know, I mean, there's been this like quite, you know, powerful reaction to the BDS movement, trying to equate BDS, for those who don't know, is the movement to boycott Israel, to bring pressure on Israel from the outside economically, which is was what worked in South Africa. You know, there's been an effort, we see it in Hillary Clinton's speech before AIPAC, to equate BDS and anti-Semitism. I think, you know, most of us are smart enough to know how absurd that is. And most of us are smart enough to understand that when people resort to that kind of argument, it's because they're scared. I don't think Hillary Clinton is scared, but I think AIPAC is nervous, because the sort of stranglehold that they've had over American politics regarding Israel is breaking. And among American Jews and among Americans overall, I think, you know, it's hard to hide what's happening there. And it's hard for even people who have historical, like deep historical attachments to the state of Israel, are finding it more and more painful to observe what's happening there, and heartbreaking to see what's happening there, and are realizing they can't support it anymore, and that some pressure has to be brought from outside. So I think that movement, which is spreading around college campuses, is a very good reason to be optimistic that, you know, perhaps not with our next president, but that. Whoever it might be, but the American politics is shifting, and even like this conversation that we're having today would have been pretty hard to have 5-10 years ago. That people are talking about this in a way that they were unwilling to and afraid to, I think, quite recently, and that does give me some small hope.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Ben.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, and Errant Fox. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, Sharon Oxborough, the Estate of Suzanne Aaron, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support is provided by LA Weekly, KCRW 89.9 FM, and KUSC 91.5 FM.